is Over the Garden Gate, a program brought to you by the University of California Cooperative Extension Master Gardener Program of Tuolumne County. The mission of the UCCE Master Gardeners is to provide research-based gardening information to the public. If you would like to contact our Master Gardener Program, please call our hotline, which is area code 209-533-5912. The hotline is not manned full-time, but we do pick up our messages and we will get back to you within the week.
Hello, everybody. This is Debbie Powell, the Master Gardener Coordinator for both Calaveras and Tuolumne County. And this is going to be a great day because I get to interview Scott Onetto, who is our farm advisor for the Central Sierra. Hello, Scott.
Hi, Debbie. Thanks so much for having me today.
How are you doing?
Oh, fabulous.
Well, good. And we haven't seen you as much as we have in the past when I know, number one, it's due to COVID. But the other thing is you're spending more time on research projects.
Yeah. I've been able to get out in the field quite a bit, even during this last year with all of us being fairly isolated. I still have had an opportunity to get out and do a fair amount of research here in the foothills. So it's great to be here to talk about some of those projects today.
Oh, good. One of them, and I didn't realize, I have to admit, that it was such a problem. I knew it was a nasty weed, but that was only because of your booklet that you put out there. And that is the skeleton weed. Am I saying that right?
Yeah. So it's one of the common names is skeleton weed. Another common name that people often associate with it is called rush skeleton weed. Usually people just call it skeleton weed for short.
And is that throughout the foothill area or is it just in certain areas? Where do you find this?
Yeah, it is fairly limited to California. Throughout the Sierra Nevada foothills, you will find it in the valley and a couple other areas along the coast. But it's been here for quite some time. It was first, I think, identified here in California during the early 1900s. And as so many, it's a non-native plant. It's a weed from European origin, so it was brought to the Americas, back in the early 1900s, maybe possibly even the late 1800s, but it's been here for, at least 100 years, but as so many weeds we often find, they often don't always just explode as soon as they've been introduced. Sometimes they'll just have these smaller populations, and then over the course of in this case, maybe 60, 70, 80 years, then it finally really starts ramping up and becoming more widespread.
Just kind of curious, why does it start ramping up? I mean, what causes the change?
Yeah, it might be partly, acclimating to its new environment, right? So, it's hard to say what exactly causes that immediate or that that ramp up, but it's not unique to skeleton. We see it with things like yellow star thistle, Medusa head, so many of our weeds that have been introduced from other parts of the world. They often get here, and again we don't see them explode all of a sudden. Usually you just kind of see them creeping along with the population just slowly going up for quite some time. And, it's hard to say you can't really put a time frame on it, but usually after a period of time, that's when the weeds just start exploding. Then you see sort of this really rapid expansion in their population. And so I would say for skeleton weed, we've been seeing it. It's been in some of our more northern Sierra Nevada foothill counties, especially El Dorado County up into Placer and Nevada counties. It's been up there and spreading for probably the last 40 years. And more recently, I'd say in the last 15 to 20 years, we've been seeing it move down the Highway 49 corridor. And now we're seeing it spreading rapidly through parts of Amador County and into Calaveras County. So it's probably, you know, the again, could be all sorts of different things that are contributing to that, both just in terms of how the weed spreads, it moves along the highways and the roadways. And so I'm sure, you know, we are helping the weed spread, but I'm also, you know, assuming that the plant is, through just, you know, yearly generation of making new seed, those plants, there's some genetic variability probably there, and they're becoming just more accustomed to California's climate.
Goodness. Now, I hate to ask this, but I don't think there's a problem with this weed where I am. But let me ask you, I'm trying to remember from your weed book, which is so great. I mean, that's a great little handout. And it's also online. Is this one of those take action weeds?
It is. Yeah. It's right now it is classified. So the Department of Food and Agriculture in California, it's the regulatory arm of agriculture in the state. And they have a ranking system for noxious weeds in terms of how they pose, basically pose harm to agriculture. And this one is currently listed as what is called a Class B weed, which means that it's a pretty important pest, and they leave it up to the county agricultural departments as to how to best try to combat that weed. If they have the resources to try to battle that weed, they can do so. So it's not as widespread as something like yellow star thistle, where that is in a different category because it is become so widespread. So it's still, I would say, skeleton weed is still in many cases treatable in some of these smaller populations, but it's definitely something people should be aware of.
Okay. So now, since I said that I don't really feel that it's a problem where I live, why should I be concerned about it at all? I mean, should I just mark this off my worry list and yeah, not even think about it again?
Yeah. So, you know, as kind of, you know, I would say everybody should, take part in knowing what's growing in and around them. If you have, 5 acres or so, and maybe you have a couple of livestock, maybe you have a couple goats, or maybe you have some sheep, or maybe you have some cows, you should definitely be aware of this weed. It can it can pose some harm to those animals. It from its name, skeleton weed, it kind of looks like a skeleton. It doesn't have really many leaves on it. It has just these wiry stems, and these stems can cause all sorts of mechanical injury in animals when animals eat it. So these little pieces of basically wiry stems can get lodged in the animal's intestines and in their stomach, and just cause all sorts of issues. There also has been some cases where could be considered poisonous, maybe in higher amounts, but mostly it's the mechanical issues where we have problems with animals. But for others, if you just live, in a subdivision, or maybe you just have, a home with a small lot, I think people still should be concerned, because I guess more recently, I'm starting to see this weed make its way into home landscapes, which we'd never seen before. This was always a roadside weed moving into rangelands, but now more recently I'm seeing it pop up into people's landscapes. And again, why it's a problem, because it's these noxious weeds that we often talk about are extremely competitive. So this is a perennial plant. So it forms this very, very deep taproot that can compete for, water, soil moisture, nutrients, all of those other things that are often limited for plants that we want in our landscape. And so from that standpoint, I think everybody should be at least aware of it. I'm seeing it more and more now pop up into commercial landscapings. Just recently, I was down at our local post office, and their entire front planter box was nothing but skeleton weed.
Oh my gosh.
So yeah, it's like I said, it's super competitive and it's able to outcompete so many other plants. Often it'll just crowd those plants out over time.
Is it like so many weeds where when it's little, it looks cute and harmless?
Yeah.
And then when it gets bigger, it kind of still looks pretty, because doesn't it have a flower?
It does. Yeah. So when it's small, so I mentioned it's a perennial. So when it first germinates from a seed, it looks much like a dandelion. So this is in the sunflower family. So it's very closely related to things like dandelions. So it's got this little, what we call rosette of leaves. It looks just like a dandelion for a portion of the first year of its growth. And then in the springtime, it goes through this very, very rapid growth stage where it puts on these very big, lengthy stems that are, again, pretty much leafless, and then produces these little yellow daisy-like flowers that are quite attractive. I mean, they're fairly small. They're probably about a quarter of an inch in diameter, but still a pretty yellow color.
Wow. So what is the best way to get rid of it? It doesn't sound like something we should have, even if it is cute looking.
Yeah. So, you know, in the home landscape, I would say if you see it, hand pull it if you can. Hand pulling works great, especially for those newly germinated plants that are super small that look like dandelions. You could just pull them out. As the plants get larger after that first year, I mentioned they produce this very deep taproot. So it is possible still to pull those plants up, but you have to be careful. You need to make sure you get all of that root structure. This plant, and one of the reasons why it is so competitive, is it can re-sprout from root fragments. So, you know, if you pull it up and you leave some little fragments of the root in the ground, those little fragments can grow new buds and make a new plant. And so that's why we're seeing it such a problem in many agricultural settings, especially in vineyards, where one of the ways many growers will often do weed control to limit the use of herbicides is they'll till in their weeds or cultivate in the springtime as the soil is starting to dry out. So they'll basically, you know, go in there with a disc or a cultivator and they'll chop up all of those weeds early in the season. But with this weed, as they are finding, as they go through and they do that cultivation, they're basically just chopping up all of those roots and spreading the roots all throughout their vineyard. And then the following years, they have just this nightmare of so much more skeleton weed because they just spread it all through their vineyard. So,
oh my gosh, that is a nightmare.
Yeah, yeah. So I have just recently started a research project in vineyards because we are seeing so much more skeleton weed in vineyards, and we're trying to figure out real life solutions for these grape growers that are basically trying to figure out how to control skeleton weed. As I mentioned, it's got this very deep taproot, and it's competing with the vines for, again, limited soil moisture and nutrients. And so in areas where there's lots and lots of skeleton weed, we're actually seeing it compete very strongly with the vines, which ultimately reduce quantity and quality of the grapes, and just an ultimate economic loss for the growers.
Because they're not going to get as large a harvest.
Correct.
Because there's only so much water and nutrients available.
Exactly. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. How interesting. Now, you did some information about your research project on YouTube, which is fascinating. That really is. That's fascinating. And that is, if I've got this right, it's on the UCCE Central Sierra YouTube. And you can find it there. I don't have the exact link right now, but I watched part of it. And it was amazing. You pulled out a skeleton weed. And those roots, when you say they're, you know, very aggressive and vigorous, it looked like it was about maybe a half inch. I mean, it was like looking at a stick in the soil. That's how aggressive these roots are.
Yeah, you can kind of think of it like almost like a carrot root. I mean, they are very, very rooted perennials. And so And what we see in vineyards is, you know, they'll grow right up against a vine, all surrounding the vines, in between the vines, in the rows between the vines. And so when you start thinking, you may have, you know, hundreds and hundreds of plants just in a small, you know, 10 foot by 10 foot area. You can only imagine how much water and nutrients these weeds are taking up. And one of the, you know, the other, layers to this problem is that these are very late maturing plants. And so, you know, where many of the weeds and vegetation that grows in vineyards occurs through the winter months and then into spring. And then as the soils start to dry and the rains begin to end, those plants are annuals and they start to die. But this thing being a perennial, it continues to grow through the spring and into the summer months, and competing again with those limited resources that the vines so surely need. And so and so that's one of the other just big reasons is we don't, you know, have too many perennial weeds that are often in these orchards and vineyards. So really trying to get some good control strategies that are effective is going to be really, really important.
Well, Scott, I sure appreciate you talking with me about this problem. And we'll have to have you back, but we just simply ran out of time. But I thank you so much. This is fascinating.
Great. Thank you. Yeah. Check out the YouTube video that we just finished up on this trial if you want to see more information about the project.
Okay. Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
This is KAAD LP 103.5 FM, Sonora, California.
Hello, everybody. This is Debbie Powell. I'm the Master Gardener Coordinator for Calaveras and Tuolumne. And Linda Reevely, our Tuolumne Master Gardener, is here at the UCCE office with me. Hello, Linda.
Hi, Debbie. How are you today?
Great.
Good.
And we are doing you're the one doing it, a book review on another fabulous book. What is it?
Well, this is a book that I'm real fond of. It's called Attractive Native Pollinators: Protecting North America's Bees and Butterflies. This is the Xerces Society Guide to Native Pollinators. And it's a very comprehensive book with beautiful photographs and a lot of information. As they say about food, it be nutrient rich. This book is intellectually nutrient rich.
Oh my gosh, I love that.
It's a beautiful book. And it's 370 pages of information about bees and butterflies and other native pollinators, and what can be done to save them and what can be done to encourage them to play a better part in our environment.
You know what, Linda? I'm going to be the devil's advocate here. Do we really need to be concerned about this?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, should we just be a little concerned, or, is this something really to...
We need to back up here. We need to be majorly concerned.
Okay.
The absolute health of our planet depends on maintaining these ecological structures that one of the biggest players in the whole structure are pollinating insects. Every plant that produces seed needs to be pollinated in some way. Plants like grapes are actually self-pollinated before the grape even emerges. Wheat is pollinated by the wind, as is corn. But most other plants require a pollination experience, essentially, where pollen from one flower is taken to the next flower, fertilizes that flower. The flower can at that point grow seed. Seed ends up on the ground somewhere, sprouts, becomes new plants. It's the absolute cycle of that side of plant life.
And
ferns don't do that. A few other plants don't do that. But the vast majority of food things we eat have to be pollinated. Fully about 75% of the plants we eat for food require pollination.
But a lot of times, I think it's kind of difficult to understand the importance of it, because we actually
don't even really look at bugs. I mean, we don't. I mean, I mean, a lot of people. I mean, we look at birds, we look at mammals, we look at the animals around us, we look at plants. But the last thing in the world we really, or I'm just speaking in general terms,
right,
is really to pay attention to the bugs in our life.
To insects.
Sometimes a lot of us have grown up with the philosophy that bugs are bad, and if you have a bug in your house, you should kill it.
Yes, or a bug outside, you should kill it.
Right.
The only good bug is a dead bug. The real problem with that is that we don't really understand the enormous complexity of the lives of insects.
That's true.
How they operate in nature.
That's true.
And your house, whether some of us a little more than others, is certainly a part of nature.
That's true.
And those insects, you know, there are insects that live in your house innocuously, and there's insects that cause damage to your house. We're all taught as children, like flies, are dangerous vectors of disease. I'm old enough to remember the polio epidemic, and flies were a primary vector of polio.
Oh.
And so I grew up being absolutely terrified that a fly might land on anything I was ever going to eat.
Which interesting
is something to consider,
right?
But that doesn't mean that fly doesn't play an important part in the cycle of life.
Okay,
and that it doesn't have its own place to be and its own, you know, reason for being.
Right.
These things are all incredibly intertwined. And I didn't really become interested in insects myself until I decided to keep bees.
And
bees are one of a few kinds of highly social insects that people have been involved with for many, many years, since probably, pre-Stone Age.
Wow.
People were probably collecting honey from beehives, and certainly other animals do it as mm-hmm. well. And so bees are kind of a gateway insect for an interest in insects, a lifelong interest in insects. But pollinators are a much wider group of insects and other animals.
Okay.
And this book is really an interesting book. The first chapter, which you just covered nicely, is why care about pollinators.
Oh.
And because they're important. It's right. an important part of what keeps us all alive. It talks about how pollination works and who these pollinators are. There's bees, there's native bees. You know, there's over 1,600 different kinds of native bees in California alone.
Oh, I had no idea. Absolutely none. That's interesting.
Know. Wasps, flies, butterflies, and moths, beetles, all of them are important pollinators. Even ants are important pollinators for some plants.
Oh, my goodness.
And so we really need to think about that when we spray poison around our house.
Right.
Or go to the store to buy something to kill aphids and end up with the most powerful kind of insecticides available today, which are the neonicotinoids, and go home and decide to spray that all over everything.
Oh, goodness.
You can knock off entire communities of insects with one foolish action.
And it's so easy to do.
It's terribly easy to do. They're tiny little creatures, and they're very susceptible to some things. Now, other threats, habitat loss.
Okay.
We systematically have destroyed habitat for insects. In the Sierra alone, where we find cattle or sheep grazing, if they overgraze a certain area, it tramples the bumblebee habitat so badly that the bumblebees completely disappear from the area.
Oh my gosh. I had no idea.
I know, it's an amazing thing we don't think of. There are other things that are probably hard on them. Of course, the widespread spraying of insecticides. And obviously, if Zika virus is bearing down on you and your family, you want us to spray for mosquitoes.
Right.
But we really need to take care and to know that that needs to be an occasional occurrence, not a daily kind of application of insecticides.
Right. Not a way of life. Okay.
Because you destroy far, far more than just mosquitoes when you spray. Now, this book also has a real interesting section on taking action. Things that you yourself can do. How to get interested in, say you play golf.
Mm-hmm.
There's a whole section in here on helping to create new habitats, bee-friendly parks, and golf course management that you could introduce your golf...
How interesting.
...your golf course landscape folks to,
sure,
to help them do a better job.
Uh-huh.
If you are interested in school campuses or making an eco roof or highway and railroad right-of-ways, this book gives you some handy information about how to get involved in helping to restore habitat for native pollinators in those areas.
That is fabulous.
Pretty
that
good,
really
huh?
is. Yeah, absolutely.
I think it's pretty good. After that, we also have a whole section on the bees of North America. It is a truly encyclopedic, I hope I said that right. I grew up with teachers from Texas, and whenever I say that word, I sound like I'm from Texas. Long story, that one, but nonetheless, it really helps us to understand what the varieties are, how they work, what their place in our environment is, and how you yourself can encourage and take care of some of these insect species that aren't honeybees, which requires a fair amount of equipment and mm-hmm. some training mm-hmm. and expertise. But, for instance, mason bees will live in those funny little bee houses with the bamboo rods.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah,
those are perfect. If you just leave a few spaces of natural dirt in your garden, particularly, strangely enough, mouse holes,
uh-huh.
bumblebees will move in and live there.
Really?
And bumblebees are just amazing. They're
so
beautiful and charming.
So if you've got just leave some bare dirt.
Some bare dirt you don't walk over all the time and disturb.
Okay, and that's it.
That's it. It's all it requires. Because they dig these little tunnels and they lay their eggs in the tunnels.
Oh, fascinating.
Yeah, they're amazing. The book also has how to create a pollinator-friendly landscape with some sample gardens.
Oh,
kind
love
of like,
that.
Kind of like recipes for your garden.
Right.
And some recommended pollinator and butterfly host plants. Don't forget the butterflies. We
oh,
all
that's
love
true.
Them.
Oh, we do.
And yet the populations of butterflies have plummeted.
That's true.
You know, there are places in Europe where there are practically no insects.
That is astounding.
I know.
That's astounding. I can't imagine it.
Fortunately, we live in a place where the insect population is still fairly healthy. But there are places, even in the United States, where you can open your windows, have no screens, and never see a bug in your house.
That's amazing.
Because they've all been killed.
Oh my gosh, that's... I mean, now that we know the advantage to having the insect population, that is really a scary thought.
It's a shock.
And it
is.
It's
a really scary thought. There, like I say, there's whole sections of Germany that are completely free of insects now.
Oh my gosh. So how do they pollinate?
They bring bees in.
Oh, so then you're dependent upon a beekeeper actually shipping in the bees to the area.
Having to get in there and move the bees around.
You can't rely on the natural system taking care of itself.
And we all of us who live here in California are aware of the almonds.
Yes.
And the bringing of the bees to the almonds.
Yes, we sure are.
Do you know that those bees represent the largest insect migration in the world?
To pollinate almonds?
And they come on the backs of semi-trucks.
Isn't that incredible? That's incredible.
More insects come to pollinate those almonds than move around by themselves anywhere in the world.
Oh my God.
That includes locusts.
That is staggering. That is a staggering statistic.
Yeah, it is, isn't it?
It's
absolutely stunning.
Oh my gosh.
So this also has ideas for educators and parents, a great glossary, and a big list of information and resources that could be helpful if you're interested in this. Again, this book is called Attracting Native Pollinators, Protecting North America's Bees and Butterflies, and it's published by the Xerces, X-E-R-C-E-S, Society.
Sounds like a wonderful book, Linda.
It's a good one.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye.
Bye. You've been listening to Over the Garden Gate, a program presented by the UCCE Master Gardeners of Tuolumne County. I'm Linda Reevely. Thank you for being with us. If you would like to contact us for more information, remember you can contact our hotline, which is area code 209-533-5912,
Or you can look us up on the KAAD-LP.org website. Look for Over the Garden Gate. Thank you.